Sri Lanka is known for the communal tensions since it achieved independence from Great Britain in 1948. History of Sri Lanka has, you know, since then has been full of struggles and resistance against the capitalist system and state oppression of minorities. There were many state-sponsored pogroms against Tamils, who are the majority in the north and east of the island, but only make up less than 25% of the overall population. Discriminatory laws were introduced by the state, which forced Tamil youth to take up arms in the 70s. The armed resistance was brought to an end with brutal killings of at least 70,000 Tamils in May 2009. Meanwhile, Sinhala youth in the south also led heroic struggle against the capitalist state, leading to failed uprisings in the 70s and 80s. This part of the history is quite well known for many people who observe Sri Lanka's politics. However, like Megan said, Sri Lanka also has a beautiful history of resistance led by Western-trained young radicals who are largely forgotten in the mainstream media. Lanka Samasamaya Party was founded on 18th of December 1935 by young students who returned from Europe and America. They didn't identify themselves as a Marxist party, Trotskyist party initially. The students only launched the political party after more than 2 years of running other organizations. As Leslie Gunawardena, one of the founding members of LSSP, writes, the idea did not fall from the sky, but had been maturing for some time. Alongside Leslie Gunawardena, Enam Pereira, Colvin R.D. Silva, Philip Gunawardena, and Robert Gunawardena were among the members of the original group. So in today's talk, I'll go through how these young radicals laid the groundwork for a mass political party, the challenges they went through during Stalin's Popular Front, and how they came to be the only party in the world that managed to expel Stalinists. Building the profile of the party also involved an anti-deportation campaign of an Australian man who helped them learn lessons which would later become useful during the underground period during the World War II. They mobilized workers and led militant strikes. They revived the Surya Mal movement, selling Surya flowers as rival to pro-war poppy sales to support returned local servicemen who were abandoned by the British Empire. And this movement played a central role in relief work, supporting people affected by malaria in 1933 and 34. During the war years, they were declared an illegal organization where many cadres were jailed. In 1942, while the key leaders were in exile in India, they played a very important role to bring together all the scattered Trotskyists across India to form Bolshevik-Leninist Party of India, which was the Indian section of the Fourth International. LSSP saw a surge in membership after the war. At the 1947 election, they had 10 representatives elected to parliament. Capitalist form of production was introduced into Ceylon. That's how Sri Lanka was known prior to 1960s. Capitalist form of production was introduced through tea plantations in the 1820s, and the workers were brought from Tamil Nadu who were kept in conditions not far removed from serfdom, which meant there was no independent activity and organization among this group. Plantation economy led to emergence of skilled and unskilled labor, but the struggle of the bourgeois and the urban workers for democratic rights did not emerge till the 1880s. Sri Lankan scholar Kumari Jayawardena, she divides it into two phases. 1880 to 1920, so challenged to British imperialism through Buddhist and Hindu revival movements led by Tamil and Sinhala intelligentsia. Through this emerged the first trade union, Ceylon Printers Union, and the leadership was provided by the radical section of the bourgeois and petty bourgeois. While this phase saw numerous spontaneous strikes and few organized strikes, union leaders were often paternalistic, advocating conciliation and moderation to the working class. It is also important to note that there was rising communal tension during this period, particularly between the Buddhists and the Muslims. In 1915, a riot fueled by British fires led to killing of up to 116 people amongst the Muslim and the Buddhist community. 1920s formed the second phase of the movement for democratic rights. Ceylon population was at 4.5 million. This was a period of militant trade union struggle. Ceylon Labour Union, which was formed in 1922 under the leadership of a reformist trade union leader, Gunasinghe, with 25 members, organized a general strike in Colombo of 20,000 workers in 1923. This was followed by a wave of strikes culminating in the violent tram car workers' strike of 1929, during which police shot dead five people. Ceylon Labour Union took the fight for democratic rights a stage further than the moderate reformers of the Ceylon National Congress, which was formed by the bourgeois in 1919. Out of this, Ceylon Labour Party was formed in 1928, and it is under these circumstances of increased class struggle, British rulers decided to give increased powers to Sri Lanka's bourgeois through implementation of the Donohoe constitutional reforms, which was basically ensuring every community had a say in the functions of the state in 1931 and not one group dominated. This increase in power came without any conflicts with the British interests, and the local bourgeois and their political parties were not willing to confront and lead a campaign for independence. Just like the rest of the world, Sri Lanka faced economic depression from 1929 to 1935. During this period, militant labor movement had collapsed, and union leaders like Gunasinghe were acting as strike breakers. On the question of independence, leadership was provided by a group of youth groups, which came together as Youth Congress, and it comprised of socialist-leaning young radicals, and they hosted forums with leaders from Indian independence movement. Election was held for the first time in 1931 for the state council. Many of the Youth Congress actually decided to boycott the election, demanding Purna Swaraj, meaning complete independence from Britain. It is during this period, young radicals who were sons of the Low Country Sinhalese plutocracy, people from the coastal regions. The other section of Sinhalese is called upcountry Sinhalese, who have differing cultural practices. These young radicals went to Europe and America for higher studies. Western world was also in the midst of the vast unemployment and industrial unrest caused by Great Depression. During this period, radical socialism flourished in all UK universities. These young radicals were exposed to radical politics and became well-read on Marx and Lenin. They came to know radicals who were part of Trotsky's left opposition. When they returned to Sri Lanka, they returned to Sri Lanka via France. So they met many of these people as well. And when they returned, they founded South Colombo Youth League, made up of half a dozen returnees I think in 1933, and they founded, or they worked together with many other youth groups at that time. They were the more radical, and they were the one who had a working class orientation. The group published a newspaper in Sinhala titled Kamkarawa, means worker, and provided leadership to well over the Mills Workers Union, which covered workers in a mill in Colombo, with Colvin D. Silva, one of the founding members of LSSP, as president, and Kunak Segura as the secretary. They organized their first successful strike in February 1933, which involved 1,400 workers, which lasted till July of the same year. And this unexpected competition enraged reformist trade union leader Gunnar Singha, who promoted anti-Indian racism and tried to supply scabs to break the strike. I think this Gunnar Singha guy is a bit of a character, you know. we should do a session on him at some point. Except well of his mill strike, Gunnar Singha was generally the victor. Young radicals learned invaluable lessons of how to engage with workers and how to approach the relationship between workers and the trade union leadership, whom the workers were reluctant to abandon. As Ceylon National Congress and other bourgeois parties were not willing to provide leadership on the question of independence, an opportunity arose for young radicals to demonstrate against British rule and to mobilize larger sections of public opinion in the struggle for independence. So this led the newly formed South Colombo Youth League to initiate the revival of the anti-imperialist, anti-war Suryamal movement, where they sold Surya flowers on every Armistice Day. This movement played a central role in agitation against British rule. The effectiveness of the campaign meant that British authorities introduced Street Collection Regulation Ordinance. This protest became, you know, later became useful in the anti-malaria campaign as well. You know, during the 1934-35 epidemic, which took lives of at least 125,000 people. And the Wisconsin-educated Philip Gunawadna, who was, you know, elected to the state council, blamed the state council and the board of ministers for killing people through cutting down essential services. So these young radicals were angry, and they were convinced that all these deaths were avoidable. It was due to malnutrition caused by colonial exploitation, and they considered their duty to become fully involved in on-the-spot relief work, which resulted in them gaining long-lasting popularity and became household names. You could go to some of the towns now as well, and people still talk about these guys from the 30s. When the party was formed in 1935, it had 20 founding members. Within a year, membership grew to 80. The executive made a deliberate decision to only admit convinced socialists into the party. Later, it was open to those who subscribed to the party's aims and paid a subscription of 25 cents a month. LSSP played a dual role of fighting for national independence and socialism. They demanded nationalization of means of production, distribution and exchange, and the abolition of inequalities arising from differences of race, caste, creed, or sex. Some of the partial demands were abolition of child labor, free school books, a scheme of unemployment insurance, minimum wage, eight-hour day, rent restriction, use of Sinhala and Tamil for all government departments. And, you know, it managed to elect two representatives to the members of the legislature to propagandize the policy of the party and share its views on all important questions as they arose. They launched a Singala newspaper, Sama Samaja, in 1936, and Tamil weekly newspaper, Samadharmam, in 1938. By March 1937, Sama Samaja circulation was 14,000 copies. They also published periodicals in English language, The Young Socialist and The Sama Samajist. It continued till press was seized and sealed up by the government in 1940. By then, LSSP had done the damage. It brought politics to people, which was previously confined to the English-educated few. It brought new words to the local languages. Sama Samaja, for example, was coined as the word to describe socialism in Singala language. The party received further nationwide publicity when it tried to stop the deportation of Bracegirdle, a young Australian communist and a member of the LSSP working on the tea plantation, who was being kicked out of the country for his activism by the governor, the British governor. Bracegirdle was given 48 hours notice to leave the country by Governor Stubbs. The party decided to defy the order and hide Bracegirdle. On the night, on the rights of minorities, it demanded equal status for both languages and blamed Singala leaders of the bourgeois parties for the rising tensions between the Tamils and the Singhalese. Party's policy was that majority community can and must make generous concessions in order to form a united front to defeat the British rule. Once the party was launched, LSSP found greater success in its efforts to unionize workers. They took leadership in numerous strikes, including the two-day motor strike in 1936. But they continue to face opposition from Gunasinghe again. He's actually been roaming around from 1915 to, you know, 40s. He was becoming more and more desperate to hold on to his power. He was now leading an anti-Indian campaign to get rid of all Indian workers. This campaign to arouse racial hatred was a success, and it led to workers becoming divided and collapse of unions in workplaces. These moods began to change only with the commencement of the war and strike wave among the plantation workers. So from 1939 to 1940, there were spontaneous strikes. Two organizations that worked with the plantation workers were the Ceylon Indian Congress, which was made up of Indian workers or their representatives or the bourgeois from that section, and All Ceylon Estate Workers Union led by the Sama Samajists. On 19th January 1940, one of the plantation workers, Govindan, was shot dead during the strike and became first of the long list of martyrs of the working class in the plantations. Militant leadership was provided by LSSP, and that made a deep impression among the plantation workers. And like I mentioned at the start, one of the major challenges to the party came in its early years as communists around the world were misguided by Stalin's Popular Front. Most of the LSSP leaders were part of a secret tea faction, tea for Trotsky, were disturbed by the Moscow trials. They found it difficult to believe the confessions by leaders they respected and became disillusioned with Third International. It is during this period they became familiar with Trotsky's revolution betrayed as well. As communist parties around the world were faithfully following People's War line of the Popular Front, LSSP Executive Committee discussed their position and declared that Third International had not acted in the interest of the revolutionary working class movement. 29 of the members voted for and 5 voted against this resolution. This led to the clash between Trotskyists and the Stalinists, and shortly afterwards, Stalinists were expelled. During the war years, the Samar Samajis were in the way of the war effort, branding it as an imperialist war and opposed Ceylon's participation in it. They were consistent all the way through, unlike the Stalinists, and their militant leadership in the plantation workers' struggles led to government issuing detention orders against its leaders, and new regulations made it difficult for the party to function openly. After most of its leaders were arrested, remaining ones continued to work using cover organizations. On April 7th, 1942, 4 of its leaders escaped from jail, which led to repression being intensified against remaining members. A large number of arrest warrants were issued, and LSSP was formally declared an illegal organization. And this led to its key leaders illegally traveling to India, where struggle for independence was intensifying. In India, LSSP leaders made contact with various Trotskyists or various socialists who identified themselves as Trotskyists, brought them together and formed Bolshevik-Leninist Party of India as a section of the Fourth International. They were mostly based in Calcutta, but worked in many other cities as well. By 1943, these Samar Samajis in India were, underwent great hardship, where many were arrested and beaten in custody and jailed. Some were sent back to Ceylon, but on arrival were taken back into jail for earlier jailbreak. Meanwhile, worker members of LSSP continued to organize workers, giving militant leadership under constant danger of police raids and arrests, despite Stalinists having the support of imperials to build their trade unions. They led several strikes and were able to help the party capture leadership of the government workers' union in Colombo. And when the war ended, public pressure grew for the detained LSSP leaders to be freed. Governor at that time agreed, but only if these men signed conditions. They refused to sign the conditions, but despite that, they were eventually released. After a two-day hunger strike, the released detainees were welcomed as heroes and given receptions throughout the country. LSSP, a party that was made illegal and its opponents' sword was smashed during the war years, emerged stronger than ever before. So I'm going to wrap up with that. Ceylonese Trotskyists became a powerful political force among the working class and oppressed masses of the island, leading important struggles and winning a number of parliamentary seats. But within only a few years, they were to follow the tragic path taken by their predecessors in the German Social Democrats and other parties at the turn of the century. Having initially opposed the reactionary state structure set up by the British and the Sri Lankan bourgeois, the LSSP began to adapt themselves to it. Though it called for the attainment of national independence and the abolition of economic and political inequality and oppression arising from differences of class, race, caste, creed, and sex in the early years, but later the program did not identify the LSSP as a party of the working class, nor did it elaborate a revolutionary program for achieving socialism. It made no attempt to address any of the issues confronting the international working class, but I'm going to let Emma do the hard work of explaining their failures.
Well, I just wanted to sort of sum up, I guess, where what Aaron went through really beautifully. So the story of the Lanka Samoa Samaja Party is the story of a Trotskyist party that was able to achieve a mass following in quite a short period of time. It was central to the establishment of key unions, as Aaron went through, and able to organise really significant strikes, including a series of general strikes. And it was also central, as Aaron mentioned, to the movement for independence for Ceylon from British rule. And it was able to do this while forging a path that sought to unite workers and peasants across communal lines in Ceylon, and really importantly, taking a strong stand against the oppression of Tamils. And as a result of all that, the LSSP was the hegemonic party on the left in this period, pushing the Stalinist Communist Party to quite a marginal status, as well as a reformist, actually, although open reformist to a marginal status, at a time when particularly Stalinism was really dominant in the rest of the world. And I think those are no mean feats in a country in which working class was still a minority and in which the communal divide was becoming increasingly a feature of national politics. But as Aaron indicated, the story of the LSSP as a party of the genuine and principled left in any sense, I think comes to an inglorious end in June of 1964, when the LSSP enters into a coalition government with the Sinhalese chauvinist bourgeois nationalist Sri Lanka Freedom Party, or the SLFP, as well as the Stalinist Communist Party. And as a result, the LSSP was expelled from the Fourth International Trotsky's tendency to which it had been affiliated. And I think this open embrace of parliamentary opportunism and class collaboration was an absolute betrayal of the basic interests of workers and peasants in Ceylon, as well as the basic sort of tenets of revolutionary Marxism. And just as importantly, it was a betrayal of their long-standing commitment to Tamil rights and opposition to communalism. And from this point on, it meant that there was no principled party of the left in the country that sought to genuinely unite the working class and the rural poor, and that supported the full rights of the Tamil population. So Tamil radicals would have no consistent ally on the left from that point on, at a time when the state became really increasingly repressive and chauvinist into the 70s. So in this talk, I'm going to try and answer a bit of how and why the LSSP ultimately betrayed those principles of Marxism, of Trotskyism, so thoroughly, and to sketch out a little bit what this meant for politics on the island in the decades after. So, yeah, get out your tissues or your punching bags or baseball bats, whatever helps you deal. Maybe not baseball. So Aaron's talk took us to the period in India in the mid-40s. So the period in India, I think, was also significant because there was split in the movement in 1945. And this was essentially between a reformist faction grouped around people like Philip Gunawardena and N.M. Pereira and a revolutionary faction. And the revolutionaries favoured a merger with the Bolshevik-Leninist Party of India, so the Trotskyist Party in India, and will become known as the Bolshevik Sama Samajists. The Pereira Gunawardena section would become more and more opportunist as time went on, whereas the Bolshevik section would basically stick to their Marxist principles. At the same time, it doesn't seem like there was a lot of clarity on the revolutionary side. And the fact that they actually reunified with the reformists 5 years later, I think, testifies to that lack of clarity. This was the state of the movement as it headed into the year of independence in 1948. Independence involved a transfer of power to the Sinhalese national bourgeoisie, which took the opportunity to entrench its power by systematically disenfranchising and attacking the Tamil population. So the Citizenship Act of 1948, as well as the Indian-Pakistani Citizenship Act of 1949, rendered nearly a million Tamil plantation workers stateless, denied the right to vote, and denied employment opportunities or the right to purchase land. So these acts really heralded the beginning, I think, of a really virulent Sinhalese Buddhist national chauvinism, including a policy of state-aided colonisation and genocide of Tamils in their homelands of Tamililam in the north of the country. And these policies, I think, were used by the ruling class to bind the mass of Sinhala Buddhist peasants and workers to their project as a really classic divide-and-rule tactic. It also had the effect of disenfranchising and disempowering the Tamil plantation working class, which was, as Aaron went through, was a vanguard for the working class in Ceylon, as well, obviously, deprived the left of this group as a voting base. From this point on, national politics and involvement in the state structures of Ceylon, or Sri Lanka as it became later, really took on an increasingly Sinhalese chauvinist character. So politics and society in the newly independent Ceylon was to be Sinhalese. So what did this mean for the LSSP, which had actually become the first national opposition party in the new state? So N.M. Pereira, who was the leader of the opposition, spoke firmly in Parliament against it. He said, "I thought racialism of this type died with Houston Chamberlain and Adolf Hitler. We cannot proceed as if we were God's chosen race, quite apart from the rest of the world, that we and we alone have the right to be citizens of this country." Really firm and, you know, quite sort of flowery language against it. He also identified that the laws were deliberately designed to undermine the power of the Tamil Indian working class. But was this enough? So there's no particular indication they actually took any extra parliamentary measures against these laws. I think something that was possible, given the LSSP's implantation amongst and leadership of key sections of the Tamil plantation workers. But the LSSP's parliamentary focus meant they didn't take that option. And as one writer of the period has mentioned, the cornerstone and the test of principal politics from here on in was the issue of minority rights. And over the next few decades, the LSSP repeatedly failed that test as it continued its slide into even more sort of open opportunism and class collaboration and nationalism as it sought to become more and more integrated with the state. Soon after this, the two Trotskyist groups, which had split in 45, as I mentioned, reunified in 1950. It wasn't really on the basis of any sort of political clarification or realignment. There was actually very little political discussion between the parties. The reunification seems to have been centred on resolving some of the personal animosities amongst the leaderships of the two parties. So, for example, they sort of like promised not to beat each other up and that sort of thing. And it seems the Bolshevik faction's electoral fortunes were on the ascendant, which actually put pressure on the LSSP to seek reunification. So there was no accounting for or clarification of the party question or of anything of real political substance. And I think it actually meant that the revolutionaries were reabsorbed into a reformist party, but as a minority and oppositional faction. And while the party program put as its first aim the overthrow of the capitalist state in Ceylon, I think the actions of the LSSP became more and more oriented to adaptation to that state. So the first test for the reunified LSSP, and I think a test for all the political forces involved, was the Great Hartal of 1953, which is a name for a national general strike which convulsed Ceylon. And I think the picture behind us is one picture from that Hartal. And the strike was in response to the ruling pro-capitalist UNP governments raising the price of rice. So Balatampu, who was part of the revolutionary section of the LSSP, describes what happened next. "The toilers of town and village were not frightened. On the 12th of August, the workers and rural poor took to the streets, smashed buses, uprooted railway lines, stopped trains, blocked roads, fought the police in numerous ways, and demonstrated their power. The government, struck with terror, proclaimed a state of emergency and then sent the price of rice tumbling down. This was not all. Prime Minister Dudley Senanayake resigned soon after. The Great Hartal had proved the emptiness of Dudley's majority." And there's actually reports that the government was so terrified that the cabinet fleed to a British warship that was stationed and just docked off Colombo. They were that scared they had to leave the mainland, sort of thing. So, yeah, it was an amazing achievement, I think. But what was the actual political involvement and response of the various political forces in the strike? Well, as you can imagine, the other bourgeois anti-UNP parties, so the Sri Lanka Freedom Party, as well as the Ceylon Indian Congress, backed out of supporting the strike, despite being involved in the discussions that preceded it. So clearly the commitment to capitalist law and order and fear of the masses trumped their opposition to the government. Whereas the CP, the Stalinist Communist Party, was concerned, they joined the LSSP in calling for the strike as part of a united front. They called for a united front under the leadership of the Soviet Union and New China. That part was largely ignored. And it was clear that it was the LSSP was actually the ones who had mobilised and led the masses and having a much bigger following and implantation in the working class. So Bala Tampu, who I quoted before, he boasts about how not one single member of the CP was actually charged by the police with a Hartel offence. It was only LSSP members. Within the revolutionary and reformist wings of the LSSP, there was debate over whether the LSSP should have continued the strike beyond the one day. Revolutionaries argued it was a missed opportunity. They argued that the street fighting, direct action and so on, indicated that the strike had reached semi-insurrectionary proportions, while those who argued against it pointed to the fact that the main, sections of the main plantation working class didn't actually participate in the Hartal, so an insurrection was premature. Now, the sense I have of this is that I think the Bolshevik, the revolutionary faction was a bit ultra-left in calling for an insurrection, particularly if, the key sections of the plantation working class weren't involved. At the same time, it was very obvious that the reformists were very anxious to wind it up, quite scared and running away from this real sort of explosiveness and capacity of the working class. From this point on, really, the LSSP wouldn't sort of lead anything like this. Okay. So 1956 is the next year of note. This was the year in which, the chauvinist Sri Lanka Freedom Party, headed by SWRD Bandaranaike, forgive my pronunciation, came to political power. His first act was to end the equal status of the Tamil language and to make Sinhala the only official language of the country. And this was followed by the first of many violent racist pogroms directed against Tamils in 1958. So publicly, the LSSP actually took a principled stand here. So they opposed the communist policies in parliament. At the same time, it had actually adapted to the Sinhala nationalism by striking a no-contest pact with the chauvinist SLFP and adopting a stance of what they called responsive cooperation towards the government, including voting for the 1957 throne speech that set out this government's policy. The LSSP had gained fewer votes in this election, and the lesson the leadership learnt from this was that it had to tail the SLFP in their Sinhalese nationalism and their ability to get out this sort of small peasant, petty bourgeois vote in this manner. And I think this was a process that really accelerated into the elections of 1960, when they openly and explicitly abandoned any commitment to a revolutionary perspective in March of that year, and embraced a parliamentary road to socialism through what they called a Sama Samajist government. So what you have here is a tailing of the most backwards elements of the Sinhalese masses and of the SLFP, as opposed to a revolutionary commitment to fighting communalism and to the class struggle, actually, as a means to break down those barriers. And I think this new orientation marked a victory for the reformists in getting the LSSP to openly rule out revolutionary strategy, to accept the possibility of establishing socialism in Ceylon by parliament, and to consider the petty bourgeois, nationalist, similarly chauvinist SLFP as a somehow progressive party. And while the revolutionaries objected strongly to the strategy, they also didn't break from the party. So from here, the basis for the ultimate betrayal of the LSSP in 1964, that is of joining the bourgeois nationalist LSSP in government, I think had already been laid. It had made its peace with Sinhalese chauvinism, with class collaboration as necessary evils on the road to power. So the LSSP in 1964 not only enters coalition, it takes key posts in the national cabinet, I believe including the finance ministry. They were the first ever avowed Trotskyists to hold such posts, which is a very dubious claim to fame, if you ask me. So hand in hand with this opportunism and class collaboration, the LSSP, of course, embraced the communal Sinhalese national politics of the majority party. And this was actually at a time of rising class struggle. So there were really significant strikes by the mercantile union, by the postal workers, and key government departments. So from the bourgeois SLFP's perspective, incorporating the left was just about sort of heading off this struggle, which it did successfully. And I think it really shows the bankruptcy of the LSSP strategy had become in not seeking to strengthen those strikes and only using them really as a bargaining chip. To have a seat at the table in government. Now, as it happened, this government fell in 1965, but it was the beginning of a number of so-called united fronts of the LSSP with the SLFP and the Communist Party. Obviously nothing to do with the actual, united front that Trotsky argued for, of genuine sort of unity and struggle from below. Not joining a bourgeois government in power. I think this was seen correctly by the few remaining revolutionaries as an absolute betrayal of the basic sort of interests of Salonese workers and peasants and the basic sort of principles of revolutionary Marxism. And they finally split away for good to form the LSSP revolutionary section. However, they remained small and fairly ineffectual. And actually split off into even tiny sections soon after this. So this meant that effectively, from this point on, there was no genuine mass socialist or Trotskyist movement to speak of on the island, and no reliable ally on the left for the Tamil population. And I think in the decades after this, you see a real fracturing of the politics of the left and radical formations that emerge. And a fracturing along communal lines. So, for example, the JVP, which in English translates to the People's Liberation Front, which was formed in the 60s and led several armed revolts against government, was always Sinhalese-based and had an element of Sinhalese chauvinism. So, for example, it rejected the right for Tamils to self-determination. And the Tamil movement, with no decent allies anywhere at this point, and increasing violent repression from the state and racist pogroms, turned to armed struggle with the aim of secession. And I don't have time to go into that history in detail, but I think the subsequent history on the island underscores the tragedy of this betrayal. So a mass revolutionary party with roots in the working class, with a strong anti-communalist position, had not only been a possibility, but a reality for some time. But that reality was utterly quashed, I think, by the opportunism of the leadership and the lack of political clarity of the revolutionaries within it. So what lessons can be drawn? Well, I think this is yet another of many, many examples of the bankruptcy of the reformist approach, as well as the dangers of revolutionaries not making a clear break from it. And I guess what makes this unique is that it happened within an avowedly Trotskyist organisation. And there are some indications of how and why this happened. I would characterise a Trotskyism as something along the lines of a broad but a shallow Trotskyism, in which the sections of the leadership were one to revolutionary Marxism and Trotskyism, whereas others, sort of agreed to be Trotskyist in name, but continued reformist and electorist practice. And I think there was never any particular clarity around any of this. So you could say it operated really as a left social democratic party that is, having this massive sort of electoral vehicle and, having leadership of all sorts of trade unions, but not actually producing, Marxist cadres. And I think this was compounded by the fact that the revolutionary elements don't seem to have been as committed to party building or building cadres around them. And they actually left a lot of the day-to-day organisation of building loyal cadre with the likes of Pereira. Okay, and I think, yeah, another indication of some of their sort of lack of commitment to, yeah, sort of really building, I guess, that sort of, yeah, like Marx's cater is that they never produced a theoretical journal in Sinhala or in Tamil. So a lot of the sort of basic sort of, you know, like the, you know, they had the paper in Tamil and Sinhala. But, yeah, like the theoretical debates and that sort of stuff was all carried out in English. So obviously that excludes, you know, like, you know, thousands of people from that debate. Oh, thanks. So the second thing to take from this history, I think, is the real and absolute interconnection of Sinhalese Buddhist nationalism and the state in Ceylon. And the process of running that state. This, as I explained, had its roots in independence in 48, but became more and more pronounced in the decades after, becoming more and more entrenched into the 60s and 70s, and particularly in the 1972 Republican Constitution. So the LSSP's practice of seeking a parliamentary road, of seeking alliances with the bourgeois nationalist parties, I think inevitably meant that they would embrace the communalist politics and sell out the Tamils. There was a real, yeah, fundamental connection between class collaboration and the embrace of communalism, I think. And finally, I think, well, the LSSP in its initial phase shows the possibility of building a mass working-class Trotskyist party in the developing world. Unlike the Stalinist or Maoist or secular nationalist path taken in most of the rest of the developing world, for example, in neighbouring India, this party, at least initially, was built. I think it shows that this was and is possible. You know, it's an argument against, you know, the people who say there's a sort of structural impossibility of doing this in the developing world. The failures, I think, weren't about the possibility of doing this, but they were the political failures of the leadership. And I think we can join one revolutionary in their spirit of defiance, who in the aftermath of 1964 had this to say. All the old deserters and cowards who left, the movement now asked. Did we not tell you they are all alike? 3 decades of sweat and toil, and what have you to show? With a malicious grin, they themselves reply. 3 senior and 2 junior scavengers of the bourgeois state. Despite the grain of truth in their rhetorical answer, they are all wrong. Hopelessly wrong, including the misanthropes who chirp in, you will do the same when you are older. And I'll leave it there.